Hello and welcome to Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation. This episode is called Beside the Point, Fate and Future of Paragraphs and Indents, or rather indentation. And before I give some thoughts on what a paragraph might be, because it seems obvious but it might not necessarily be the case, I want to talk about indentation, because indentation is when we have two paragraphs or more and we want to attach them to each other. So rather than having them float on the page and having blank lines in between them, we attach them, and then the second paragraph doesn't start flush to the left, as designers say, but you push the first line a little bit to the right, so there's a little space between the paragraphs, so you can actually see that there are two paragraphs attached to one another. I think I've been thinking about this lately because I'm writing stories, sort of shorter biographical pieces by women and girls that have achieved something, and they're like publishing them online and stuff. And I realized I'm not actually using indentation anymore, which is strange for me because I'm a great fan of it. I think it's like a wonderful way of gracefully attaching ideas and like making ideas flow into one another, and structuring the flow of the story and the flow of the thought in a softer way, rather than to have blanks that seem quite stark sometimes. But I realized I'm leaving those blanks. I'm just writing in like short parcels of just 4 or 5 sentences. And so I started thinking, well, why am I doing that? What has changed from my usual writing styles? Where do paragraphs and indentations actually come from? How are they developing in the different media that we are using today, which is online, of course? So I started to put some thoughts together, and I thought it would be a good moment to produce an episode. By the way, if you hear any scratching, any noises, snoring, breathing, that's my dog who's lying next to me and sleeping, and he's just been dreaming, so like his paws are scratching on the ground, and maybe he starts like making noises. He is not interested in paragraphs, or he's focusing very, very intently and closing his eyes at the same time. So we will have a look at what a paragraph might be, and what typographers and designers have to say about paragraphs, some thoughts on the history of the paragraph and the paragraph sign as well, and then where it's going. So how do paragraphs and paragraph signs look like in digital communication, so on websites, text messages, and so on, and should be worried that there's a definite change in our habits and practices around them. Right, so what is a paragraph in the first place? It seems very straightforward, and I guess after going to, you know, having 2 years of schooling, one is able to see a paragraph. However, it might actually be, there might be more cultural understanding around a paragraph than one thinks. So if you open a Japanese dictionary and you look up paragraph, you will find danraku. But those two things are actually not quite equivalent. So if you think that a paragraph is, let's say a working definition is a tightly organized parcel of thought with one or more ideas expressed in some kind of structure. Maybe there's a hierarchy, maybe they build on one another or something like that. So there's some kind of connection. A danraku for a Japanese speaker is also a parcel of text sort of surrounded by blanks. So you can tell, you know, that's kind of a box of text, of stuff belonging together. But the connection of ideas in the danraku is much less strictly organized, can be a bit vaguer, there can be different ideas, just kind of sharing space, as it were. So it's not actually a given that ideas should be organized in a certain way and then be a paragraph. So, but for us, let's say in for English literature or maybe Western writing, a paragraph could be a certain amount of text that you understand as an entity. It creates some kind of structure, a visual structure, because it's bounded by most of the time blank lines or indentation. Somehow there's some kind of blank space around this entity of text. So that's like a visual structure. And then a paragraph also creates cognitive structures and emotional structures. So when we are more able to grasp ideas and grasp emotions that are being expressed, it gives us a sense of progress through the story, through the thought of the author. And some you know, style advices throughout the ages differ vastly. So how many sentences are in a paragraph? Is it just one sentence? Is it or like two or three? Are you expressing one thought in a paragraph or maybe more? What is a thought in the first place? And those things are going to be important for thinking about the paragraph in the digital sphere. So I just want us to kind of keep thinking about and keep questioning what we think a paragraph is and what it does and what we want it to do. So there is the paragraph that is the entity of the text, and then there's also a paragraph sign or different kinds of signs which section text off and kind of herd words into being a paragraph. And and that's a bit like parentheses or brackets, where by bracket we mean both the signs, the two little moons that look at each other, and we also mean the words inside of the brackets that are being held by the bracket. And the paragraph is the same. You have a paragraph sign, and then you also have the paragraph that is the thing in itself. Now, the paragraph sign, and I'm going to talk about the history of that now. The paragraph sign is not something we are necessarily very used to today. I believe Windows still has it, but it's just invisible, but we can kind of turn it on. And I once read an entire PhD thesis of somebody who had the paragraphs turned on, and it was not fun. There's a reason for them being invisible, just placeholders. Right, so marking a paragraph. Paragraphs are, depending on what one thinks punctuation is, and I've been exploring that a little bit in previous episodes, punctuation is a way of navigating a text, navigating the space of the page. And so paragraphs are one of the earliest ways of establishing help for the reader, perhaps even for the writer or for the person copying the text, to find their way around. Because ancient Greek and ancient Latin, so classical languages, were written in different ways than we do today. So they would write in a continuous script. There would be no spaces between individual words or between sentences. And that makes reading quite hard. So you have to be relatively familiar with the language. You have to take time. You can't just read spontaneously. You can't read spontaneously out, like pronounce the text. It probably would help, but opinions divide when people started to read silently or read aloud and so on. But what is important here is that writing would be continual, a continual script. And so it becomes quite hard to know when does an idea actually start and finish, and where is the sentence in the first place. So what people came up with was a horizontal line, sometimes a kind of square hook or something, to the left in the margins. And that would actually, this sign, this stroke, would actually signal the end of a section. The end of a speech, for example, the end of a topic, or the end of a sentence. So not actually the beginning, but the end of something. And that stroke that was in the margin to the left, so beside the actual body of the text, was called paragraph. So paragraphos from the Greek, something that's written beside something else. And this sort of paragraph sign of just a stroke to the left or a little hook has been found in manuscripts of belonging to the Alexandrian Library 400 years before Christ, before the Common Era. So very, very early. And of course, those findings are always a little bit problematic because we have to trace histories through the material that we still have, that is still extant, that's still around. So people might very well have used those things way before that, but we just don't have surviving material. But we do know, so the paragraph, the concept of a paragraph goes back way, way, way into classical times, very early. The same was for classical Rome, so there are manuscripts from 200 before Christ, before the Common Era, that used this paragraph stroke. Other ways that also very early, also around the time of the Romans, was to pick out the first letter of the first word of a new section, a new sentence or something, and enlarge that, make that somehow more visible so it catches the eye, sometimes maybe even to decorate that. What people would also do, what scribes or like copyists would also do, would be to write a little C into the text. So from the margins, actually, the paragraph, the thing that is written beside, that kind of migrates into the body of the text, and the scribe, the writer, puts a little C into the text when a new section is beginning. So that's not actually sectioning of saying something is ending here, but now we come to something is beginning here. And the C was just the first letter of the Latin word capitulum, which means head. So the starting point. Now we see that shift from marking the end of something, and now we mark the beginning of something, the head. And this is, of course, where the English word chapter comes from. What's important to know here is that it's not like a chapter like we nowadays have, which might be a sustainable amount of text, a couple of pages or even more, like 10, 20 pages. It's rather that's kind of just a section. Maybe it's even just one long sentence or one thought, a paragraph. That's kind of a chapter. So people would mark that with a C, and they would write that just right into the text itself. Now, at some point, that C, you know, to the belly of the C, the round kind of half moon, would be a little bit thicker, start to be a bit thicker, and then it would also grow a leg. So it came to actually look like a mirrored P. And this is, of course, now our paragraph sign. So a kind of fun fact here, in the 16th century, the word pilcro started to appear, and that's a specifically English word, English alternative term for the paragraph sign. And that is a kind of corruption of the French of paragraph, which over hundreds of years became paragraft, and then pilcraft, and then pilcro. So sometimes, you know, you will find the word paragraph or the word pilcro, and that sort of happened in the 16th century, and it's just a little beside the point fun fact here. Right, so we have the paragraph sign looking like a mirrored P, actually coming from the Latin word for chapter, capitulum, C, so just the C. Now, both the C and the pilcro, or the paragraph sign, in the Middle Ages would be rubricated. So I've talked about this before. Rubrication means that you want to pick out something that's noteworthy, which very often would be either a decorative sign like the paragraph, or maybe a biblical quotation, or just a word, and you want to pick that stand out from the rest of the text around it. How do you do that relatively easily? Well, you could maybe draw a frame around it, or you can change the color. most of the time, probably because black was the cheapest, most effective color for ink from the materials, which could be nuts or other kinds of fatty, like animal fat or something like that. So the ink would be black most of the time. But and then any other color, like red, for example, would need different ingredients, would be maybe more costly or take longer to produce. So red was a special color. And red was used for what is called rubrication. So when you want to pick out a word and you write that in red. So that's a different color to the surroundings. And this, again, can be considered punctuation. Just the mere fact of coloring a word or a sign or whatever it is differently to make it stand out, that tells you about how to read, right? That captures your attention. And that is already punctuation. That's also a very, very, very old practice that goes back to actually ancient hieroglyphs and maybe even cuneiform. So scribes in the Middle Ages, they would use rubrication to pick out the paragraph sign to make it even easier to navigate the text, to capture the text, to think about the text. So slowly, 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 we're accumulating ways of helping us to read. And so this rubrication, how it would happen in the Middle Ages would be not that you are one monk in the monastery with your candle and whatever, and you're copying out, and then you use this ink and that ink and this pen and that pen. You would just use the black pen and the ink to write the text, and then you would leave a little space where the rubricator would put with a red ink the paragraph sign or the C. And this would be, so the labor would be divided. You don't do everything yourself, you'll divide the labor. But text production was faster than rubricators could actually paint the little paragraph, red paragraph signs in it. So at some point, the manuscripts where some paragraph signs are missing, sometimes they're missing entirely. And this is how actually the space for a paragraph, leaving space for a new paragraph, comes into being. And this development, which really just came about from forgetting rubrication, or like not having time to rubricate. Maybe someone takes the manuscript, goes elsewhere, leaves the monastery, leaves the scriptorium, the place where people would, scribes and copyists would reproduce text. So sometimes these things can be have practical reasons, and it's not like somebody decides, oh, I don't want to do this anymore, let's not do this anymore. But very often it's just chance, serendipity. It's just the way things are. And then those things that are practical or that have pragmatic reasons become habits, and suddenly they're there. So this kind of forgetting or not having time for rubrication is kind of catalyzed, becomes faster during the time of the printing press. So in the second half of the 15th century and then the 16th century. Because how printing kind of worked is that you have your types, or you have your letters, and you set them in like a metal frame. Then you want to ink them, then you put the paper, and then you pull the lever, very heavy lever for the press, right? And then you pull the lever up, the paper reappears, you hang it up and let it dry in your print shop. But the problem is, of course, that you can only print one color. So if you want to have different colors, you need to do two print runs, as it were. You have to have space to let the paper dry, and then later you take, you put it in again, and you just ink the red places that are supposed to be red. So it takes more time. You need space in order to be able to do that at all. You need the red ink, you need the black ink, you need manpower, you need more coordination. So sure, you can maybe later sell the book for a little bit more because it has this beautiful red and black kind of play. And this would sometimes people would expect that. Like, for example, it might be a religious text, and then people were used to that from the manuscript culture, so they would expect that. So you can sell it, there's a market for that. However, it did take more time, it was more costly, And printer is actually discovered in the end that people can do without the rubrication, without the paragraph sign. Purely by leaving a little bit of space, people get used to that. The eye catches it through, you know, maybe one generation, maybe a couple of generations. We don't need the rubrication anymore. And this is kind of how we lost the paragraph sign. And today we can manage without it. But the notion of the paragraph, that stays the same, right? And indentation, that's also still there. Other kinds of section breaks beside the paragraph can be a bit more decorative. So, for example, we still have that today as well, where we have some asterisks in the line, maybe even asterisks that are shaped like a triangle. That's actually called an asterism. Then we can have a little leaf. That's called a fleuron. It can be also an ivy leaf. That's like a hedera. That's also a very, very old sign. So that also goes back 2,000 years, where scribes would draw a little ivy leaf. And I like this. I think it's really beautiful that it's not just text production. It's not just for use, but it's also just for beauty. And that's really beauty for beauty's sake. Nobody needs an ivy leaf. Can just as well just put a dot, right, to tell people, the reader, okay, here is the section that stops. But scribes would draw and would make it beautiful as well and special. What else do we have? We have other kinds of framing devices, like something architectural, or maybe a bit more of a, not just like a leaf, but like a whole twig or a whole flower or something framing the text. Those sort of bigger shapes are actually called dingbats, and I'm not inventing that. That's an actual term that is also in the Oxford English Dictionary. The umbrella term for all of those typographical devices to divide text is called dinkus. Again, this is the totally legit vocabulary. So we have our signs now, we know where they come from, and we know why we lost the paragraph sign. Now, what do typographers say about the paragraph? They have some very, very special opinions about it. And one kind of typographer designer guru is called Robert Bringhurst. And in his kind of Bible, he writes something which I think is worthwhile reading out in full. He says, typography, like other arts, from cooking to choreography, involves a balance between the familiar and the unfamiliar, the dependably consistent and the unforeseen. Typographers generally take pleasure in the unpredictable length of the paragraph, while accepting the simple and reassuring consistency of the paragraph indent. The prose paragraph and its verse counterpart, the stanza, are basic units of linguistic thought and literary style. The typographer must articulate them enough to make them clear, yet not so strongly that the form instead of the content steals the show. If the units of thought or the boundaries between thoughts look more important than the thoughts themselves, the typographer has failed. I really love how he says, well, typography and design, that's like, you can't have text without that, right? But it needs to be like more like a medium. It needs to be kind of crystal clear. And in the entirety of the 20th century, actually, there is a move of typography and design, text design, to become invisible in a way, to be present, but very much not present and not in your face, sort of minimalist even. And whether one likes that or not, or whether that is true and honest, that's the question, but that's one approach, let's say one philosophy. I also really love how he speaks about the length of the paragraph, and you know, that is questionable, what a paragraph is. One sentence, two, three, however many sentences. That is always excitingly different. And then you have the familiar form that gives us security and safety, the designer, the writer, and most of all the reader has that safety that those things will recur and there's not going to be much unwelcome surprise there. And I just really like how he, Bringhurst, anchors and locates that safety in the indentation. That however long a paragraph is, there's going to be indentation for him. He says we can use different devices to structure a text apart from paragraphing or indentation. He speaks about ornaments, enlarged letters. He speaks about outdenting, which is kind of the opposite of indenting. So you have a block text and then you want to attach two paragraphs, and the second paragraph is gonna, the first line is gonna jut out to the left rather than withdraw to the right, if that makes sense. This is not very common, but that also exists. But he says the plainest, most unmistakable yet unobtrusive way of marking paragraphs is the simple indent, a white square. So he goes for, you know, purity in quotation marks. However, he says indentations that are long can look luxurious and can give the text a tattered look. And he says, what is a long indentation? An indentation that is longer than an N or an M space. And so an N space is just the white space that an N would take or an M would take. And this might seem tiny when one thinks about it like that, N or M, whatever, but the eye is actually able to capture that. So in this, you know, thinking about paragraphs in this episode, I'm going to encourage you a lot to go and like look for yourself. Take a text that you've written or that you have on your computer and just change an indentation from just put one space or two spaces, which is even bigger than an N and an M space, and the eye will definitely see it and be able to tell difference. And a designer eye, the eye of a typographer, will definitely see the difference. Now, Bringhurst recommends to set opening paragraphs flush left. So that means that, you know, they start left, there's no initial indentation or anything like that. They start right where the other lines start as well. And an indentation should be an N space. He's also aware that we can just have paragraphs, you know, paragraph, blank line, paragraph, blank line. But he warns us, he says, well, this might look precise and crisp and you know, speedy, or it might be very useful. He says it might be useful for business memos. But here's the warning, it can come across as soulless and uninviting. And I think he really puts his finger on something important here, because why talk about this at all? Why think about this at all? What's the relevance? It's just a functional thing. Well, it's kind of more actually, because as we will see later, and again, I will encourage you to look at some websites and see how you feel about paragraphing there. When something is less connected through indentation and really just sort of choppy paragraphs with blanks, and they're quite harsh because they're so white, and then you don't know, well, how are those ideas actually connected? And is it really just a parcel of an idea? And then is there like a sentence at least that takes us emotionally and cognitively across this gap of the white space between the paragraphs? Or do we have indentation where several paragraphs are gracefully connected to one another? There are different ideas expressed in each paragraph. There is a kind of there's a kind of direction where the thought is going, but the reader and the eye is accompanied somehow. And I think Bringhurst, just these two words, soulless and uninviting, as opposed to so full and inviting, right? I think that's so telling, and they're so strong and striking. I want to, again, give some quite interesting facts, which I learned when I did research for this, because typographers and designers have their own language for organizing the page, right? And it's all really about working with space and working with the black marks, which is the text or the decoration that you have. So like when you have a Windows text and you feel like, well, here's a line break, and when I'm printing it out, it doesn't look good. So maybe you add another paragraph elsewhere. You shuffle some words around. Maybe you enlarge the title or something. That is all the work of a designer, right? You're doing design work there, and the designer does the same. And what they want to be is that the paragraphs stick together and don't kind of spill across pages from left to right, or even worse, from right to left, right? When you actually have to flip a page. Imagine that. Horrible. So there are actually terms for when this happens. And one of them is, for example, a widow. So when you have a paragraph at the bottom of the left page, when you open a book and you have the left and the right page, and at the bottom of the left page is a paragraph, and then the last line spills over to the page to the right, and the last line is just at the top of the right page. That's called a widow. The line is widowed. Why? Because it stands alone, and it stands alone at the top of the family, as it were, of the family of the new page. So what you want to do is to reshuffle some other paragraph, some space previously, to make that widow slip back onto the previous page, back to her actual family paragraph, and not be alone anymore. The flip side of that is the orphan. That is also a lonely line, as it were, but that is the first line of a paragraph. So you would, for example, have a paragraph starting at the bottom of, let's say, the left page, one lonely line, and then it continues at the top of the right page, all the rest of the sentences. So this little first line is alone at the bottom. It starts at the bottom, and like at the bottom, you know, in the world, as it were, like an orphan sadly does. So it stands alone at the bottom. It's called an orphan. So we need to again reshuffle something, maybe force a break earlier, so that every paragraph sits nice and snugly on the page, and there's no lonely lines. This can be done, as I said, through forcing breaks elsewhere, through negotiating other inconsistencies, for example, adjusting kerning. Kerning is the space between two letters in a word, and we will come to that. Actually, it's a fascinating process, because that's a very complicated algorithm. Word, for example, the Word program can do it, and that means it's squeezing a word, for example, or sort of enlarging it ever so slightly, that our eye cannot catch it actually. And in order to make the text, the body of the text, nice and aligned left and right, so that there are no gaps between different words. Every word, however long the word is, has it like proper space before and after it, and there's those spaces are not too big and not too small. This is really, really sophisticated stuff, and that is what a designer or a computer system for designing would do, that it kind of automatically readjusts in very, very small ways in order to not have those lonely lines, and in order to have a clean, relatively symmetrical, orderly looking page and lines. Right, so why do we have indentation in the first place? I've already talked a bit through Brinkhurst about the soulful and inviting look of indentation, and I do think that That's a kind of soft way to create structure for the reader and maybe for the writer themselves. But this is subjective, of course. A more obvious reason would be that indentation saves space. And saving space means saving paper, and that means saving money. So, in I think it's safe to say that at any point in time where paper was being used, or parchment, or other kind of writing material, today when we print something out, the paper will be the expensive stuff, not the ink, not even the manpower, or the man or woman writing or typing or copying or something like that. But the paper, the material, is the most expensive part of a book. So I tried to wrap my head around this by doing a tiny little calculation. So I just picked up any book that was lying on my desk, and it was quite a small sort of A5 book that fits into your hand. And it has 38 lines on one page. So let's imagine that somebody prints a book without indentation. So every paragraph needs to be a standalone paragraph floating on the white page. So let's just say even someone has on a page, on the small page of 38 lines, three paragraphs. That makes two blank lines, right? And if a book, let's say the book has 300 pages, and every page of those books on average has two blank lines because it has three paragraphs, that makes actually 16 pages per book. So rather than to have a 300 page book, you would have 316, right? Or actually your book isn't as long as in 300, but 284. Let's say the book has 300 pages, 16 of those will be just blank. All the blanks between the paragraphs taken together. With a print run, let's say, of a very moderate amount of 1,500 physical books that you actually want to print, those extra 16 pages become a staggering 24,000 pages. That's crazy. When I got this calculation, I was like, this can't be true. But of course, the more you print, like, the bigger the number will be. So if you would put, rather than actual blank space between your paragraphs, but indentation, which is just an N space or an M space at the beginning, and then you just continue the printing the text, it's an enormous amount of paper that you can save, which is also, makes the book smaller, so it's more portable, so less transportation costs or storage costs, that can be attractive for readers as well. What else? Maybe in the Renaissance, you would have to stitch the book together and bind it together. Again, more paper, more work, you know, takes longer, is a bit more bulky. So there's just a lot of practical thought behind indentation as well. Right, so we talked about typographers think about paragraphs and indentation, why indentation might be practically useful. Now in the second half, or like towards the end now of this episode, we're going to look at technology. How does paragraphing and indentation change with the change of technology from paper and the printing press to, or like typewriter, to the internet and the word processor? A disclaimer at the beginning, it seems like indentation is definitely disappearing. And what a paragraph is, the notion of a paragraph, that also becomes somewhat loose and is being unmoored. I think those are both probably worrisome developments, but also exciting. And if they're quite as worrisome as they might seem right now, if I would say that's the digital age is the death of the paragraph and the and indentation and the death of punctuation in the first place, we will see whether that is the case. So, paragraphs are also connected to length of sentences, how many sentences one would like to have in a paragraph. That is very important to the technological changes that we're going to look at. The UK government on its website says, I think that's from 2015, that none of the words it uses on its pages is going to be longer. None of the sentences is going to be longer than 25 words. Because they say, and that's a quotation, when you write more, people understand less. Apparently, they base their policies on some kind of research that, at least online, people have apparently less focus, which might very well be true. 25 words is not very much at all. And even in the press release that was speaking about the program to shorten sentences on websites, those very sentences were longer than 25 words. Just like a delicious irony. But this is maybe something to keep in mind, that there is a kind of trend towards shortness and supposed clarity through shortness. To compare sentence lengths is a little bit of a tricky business, and there's somebody who's done that, who's written an entire book about the English paragraph. That was Edwin Hughes, and he has these tables of sentences from 500 years ago, so from around 1520. He actually, his study goes up to around 1920, because that was when his book was written. And he looks at how many words are in a sentence and how long the paragraphs are. So how many sentences in a paragraph. I think this is a little bit misguided. And Hughes himself, after pages and pages of comparisons, comes to the conclusion that there are as many kinds of paragraphs as there are ideas. This is something that one could have known before, because there are so many factors that come into the length of a sentence and the number of sentences in a paragraph. For example, paper space, as we have just discussed, and genre. So maybe, you know, you would expect different things in a cookbook or in a recipe or in a historical study about Napoleon, or in English drama or poetry. So maybe a study based on genres would make more sense, but still you have those practical situations to think about. Then the education of the writer, then the fashion at the time, the taste. Is there a taste for long sentences? Is there a taste for short sentences? What about punctuation? Does the writer use diversity of punctuation marks? If people don't use colons, well, it's very obvious that sentences will be shorter. And this might be a useful exercise if one takes it with a pinch of salt, that there are a lot of factors that, you know, come into play and that one cannot perhaps control for. But in any case, there is a trend now on websites to go for shorter paragraphs, fewer sentences, or indeed just one sentence. Now, please do have a look at websites like the BBC, and you will find that the BBC really pushes the notion of paragraph to a different limit, because hardly any paragraph will be longer than one sentence. So if you catch a two sentence paragraph, you're going to be lucky. There are many reasons for that. Partly, for example, that people tend to read the news on their phone, and a big block of text on the phone, which is not actually very much on the screen, which might be 2-3 sentences on the screen or on paper, that might look quite full on the phone. So blank space is being used for ease for the eye. And indeed, it might be kind of understandable, because when we scroll through a website on the phone or even on the computer, we don't have all the information that a book gives us where we are in the text, right? When you have a book, you flip the pages, so like your hands, your left thumb, your right thumb tells you something about where you are in the book, how much is still to come, how much you've already read. It's a haptic, so you hold it, right? You feel it. You have the action of flipping the pages. That tells you something. You have the margins, you have page numbers, title, chapter titles, and so on. And there have been plenty of studies that show that this kind of information that the physical object gives us helps us find places later. So you read a big fat Dickens novel and you know where something was because your hands tell you, in a way. Your brain and your hands are connected in remembering and realizing and grasping the structure of the novel. And actually, there have also been studies that we have more empathy for characters and for stories in the novel when we read a book rather than an e-book or just on the screen. That's also something very important, I think, that the ethical side of reading needs to think about. We need to think about that too, the creation of empathy through reading and the physical object. So when that is not the case, when we don't have that kind of physical information and we just scroll, we might have this little tab to the right, which kind of goes down, up and down, depending where we are on the page. And sometimes it's very tiny, then we know there's a lot to read, and sometimes it's bigger. Sometimes, though, you have websites that are full of advertisement at the bottom, and then you kind of feel cheated because you thought it was a long article, and then it's not, actually. So one way to counterbalance that, I feel, is when websites tell you this takes 6 minutes to read, or this is a 5,000-word article, hoping that you then know, you know, how long that is, helping you to gauge. And to have those blanks between paragraphs might be help for us to do that, a kind of scaffolding. Although, whether that's really, whether that can really replace, you know, flipping the page and holding the book, I guess I don't think so. But there we are. Websites like the BBC, for example, tend to just give us these sort of chunks and these fragmented sentences, news in a fragmented sentence. Again, we might want to think about the ethical side of news, as it were, that are so disconnected. Can they really tell us stories? Can they really go into depth and make those connections if the structure isn't connected? That's also something to explore, I guess. The question is, we have the change of a notion of a paragraph. Maybe now it's just one sentence. What about indentation? Can we not just indent those one-sentence paragraphs? No, that's actually not possible on the web. And this is fascinating, really, because while Windows Word, for example, or other kind of, you know, professional printing services have those algorithms that can indent, that's a bit trickier on the web. So possibly indentation would be possible through browsers, but if your text is not justified to the right, indentation will look ragged and actually tattered. What does justification mean? So when you have a text and you want it to be a block of text, right? So all the lines to the left start one on top of another at the same place, as it were, to the right, and then they go to the right. And if they don't all end at the same place as well, that's an unjustified text. That text is called ragged right. Online, the browsers are not able to justify anywhere you look. And I've looked at several websites where there's text that is really thousands of words long, so real essays. None of them is justified to the right. They're all ragged because the browser simply isn't capable of justifying. And I find that so beautiful because you can have a primary school kid that has had exposure to texts for 1 year maximum, starts writing, and you know, is learning about how a text might look like, how we want it to look like. It's a question of familiarity as well. So the child will look at more and more and more texts that are justified, because most of our books have justified margins where it's just a block. So the child will be able to do that. And the supercomputer is not able to justify. And I find that so beautiful. What would happen if you wanted to justify a text online? It would be there would be no adjustment, no kerning, as we had, you know, no squeezing of letters, no enlarging anything imperceptibly. It would just be massive gaps between words. Those are called rivers, and that really would look quite ungainly and quite difficult to read. So that is why there is no justification online. It's too hard for computers to do. And if there's no justification, to use indentation is creating a kind of messy, busy look. My dog is actually awake and looked at me a little bit, curiously, and that's probably because now I'm gonna talk about texting. So that's like an interesting subject, because it really has all of us as participants in this great experiment that digital communication is. Really, it's just so young and so democratic in a way that we all are both, I guess, exposed to it and as well shaping it by our practices and by what we believe and what we do and how we read and understand. So, of course, there are emails that are near to letters in a way, so we can paragraph, we can even indent if we so want. And then there is instant messaging, either it's a text message, a usual text message on the phone, it's WhatsApp, it's Facebook, and whatever else there is. Instant messaging, that's kind of, real-time transmission, or something that is quasi-real-time, that's felt and perceived as synchronous. But isn't actually necessarily, because we see that somebody is typing, or when there's a typing awareness indicator, and that's an interesting phenomenon, how typing awareness indication creates anxiety. come here, he's changing places. So typing awareness indicators produce anxiety, especially in romantic relationships, because they tell us that somebody else is typing, and so we're maybe anxiously waiting for the other person to finish their typing. Sometimes it might be very long. Maybe we have a conflict via text message, via WhatsApp, and so sometimes we see that somebody's typing, and then the typing stops and no text has been sent. That also creates anxiety because we think, okay, the person was writing something that they want to rethink, or it's kind of it's kind of torture to know that there has been some action and we don't actually see the result. But back in the days when real-time transmission happened offline, so that predating the internet when computers were connected, letters would actually appear as they were written. And I think part of me is thinks that's a horrible thing to see the actual letters that the person is writing, and the person not being, or me the writer, not able to actually choose, change, edit, and change my mind, because no matter how far we think that text messaging is conversational, and it is, right? It's definitely more conversational than an email, because there's at least the possibility that we can do it at the same time, right? Whether we sit in Paris and Tokyo, or whether we sit next to one another and kind of talk, in quotation marks, there is a sense of the conversational in text instant messaging, but there's still the boundary of writing and typing and being able to change your mind, which you can't do when you speak, right? What's out there is out there. But this is just an aside. So with the spread of social media and smartphones, which are quite young actually, WhatsApp, in 2009, that's just like barely a decade, right? Those changes have been quite profound in the way that we approach text and written communication and how we behave with one another. Now, I'm old enough to remember a time without computer and a time without mobile phones. So when mobile phones came, we had to pay for one text message, right? For one short message. And so we would try to put as much information into this one message, because any start, even if you would just send one letter, in the next message you would have to pay for the full message. So that's where, of course, abbreviations come from, like LOL, or getting rid of punctuation because that's spaces, that's characters, and no capitalization, and a kind of squeezing and collapse and kind of atomizing, making the most of the space that there was. We will see how this changes when it comes to WhatsApp messages, because, for example, or Facebook messaging, because we don't actually pay anymore, almost nothing at all, for our messages. They can be as long and as endless as we like. And again, this is the kind of chimera, or the kind of illusion of talking. You know, endless talking doesn't cost us anything. Now, when this is the case, we might actually just send the message off, right? Back in the days, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when you would send the message off and it just has one sentence, well, that's your own fault, right? Now, we can just send fragments of sentences, one sentence messages, emoji, you know, just like a exclamation mark or whatever it is. And it doesn't cost us anything. And we can just do like a quick fire, speedy shooting of single sentence messages, for example. We can also have paragraphs of several sentences that we send as one message, you know, and then it appears as like a bubble. So there's definite a parcel that's a definite visual shape of saying this is one message, no matter what that message contains, right? Can be several sentences, one sentence, an emoji, whatever, maybe even emptiness. And then we can have sending a message that consists of several paragraphs with blanks in between. This is, for example, possible on the phone, right? If one writes on the desktop, then, for example, Facebook messaging, that's not possible to use the enter key would mean not making a space and not going to the next line, but actually sending off the message. So I am aware that there's a difference here, and this is important for what's going to come. But when we text, I, for example, sometimes I send proper long messages. That's actually called texting novel writing or something like that. I think there's a term for people who who do that. So I would send a long message of maybe 3 or 4 paragraphs with blanks in between, and everything's proper, you know, punctuation and spelling and capitalization and so on. And then sometimes I would just shoot off one sentence per message, and sometimes, most of the time, probably I think I have 1 paragraph per message, and the paragraph consists of several sentences. So I want you to go off later and have a look at your text messages, what your habits are, you know. Do you have certain habits for certain people? Maybe like your partner, you have like witty banter. And so it's a quick exchange of just one message fragment. Or maybe to a colleague, you might have a more of a, not email-like exchange, but definitely more formal kind of formal exchange with a concern for orthography and spelling and punctuation. And maybe then even, depending on the theme, probably you have several paragraphs with those blanks. I've asked around on Twitter and my Facebook friends as well, and the voting has been quite interesting. So the Twitter survey of 24 votes offered, surprisingly, 54% of people to prefer one sentence messages. So writing one sentence, sending it off. Writing one sentence, sending it off, rather than to have a bit of a sustained approach. 38% write one paragraph per message. That might be several sentences. And then only 8% are so fussy like me and have several paragraphs in one single message. For my Facebook friends, that was kind of the opposite, or like another way around. They also, there are very few people who do this long novel writing texting, but most people prefer writing a whole paragraph with several sentences as one message. And then only a few people would go for the quick fire exchange. One friend said, with the kind of build up of having several paragraphs, she wants to build suspense. And so she uses those things in a very conscious way. And again, lots of people were writing to me saying, well, it really depends on whether we write on the phone, whether we write on the computer, because on the computer we can't even do any paragraphs. We would like to maybe, but we can't. Lots of people have said it really depends on what I want to say, how I want to say it, to whom I'm speaking. So we are quite aware of what we're doing. One friend said, and I have her consent to read out her words verbatim. She is one of the people who just, you know, sends one sentence messages one after the other. And she says, I am needy, and it's my unconscious way of making sure all those message noises get your attention. And I think that's perfect, because that's exactly, you know, one effect of the possibilities that we now have, right? And it might be very effective. The flip side of that is, another friend said she would actually not read those kinds of messages, because when she sees that, you know, there are maybe 5, 6, 7 messages, so, you know, Facebook tells you how many messages there are in one between you and the other person, she might tend not to read them and procrastinate because she feels overwhelmed and she feels like it's too much. And this might be, you know, lots of long messages and she needs to attend to them, or she feels pushed or something. So one way is getting attention, and the other way is actually opposite, not reading it because you feel overwhelmed. But I think the kind of tenor is the same, and that is that we know very well how to use those things. We know we're very adept at reading the tone and reading the feeling of the other person, the feeling of the writer, when they write fast messages, paragraphs, when they take more care, when they shoot things off. And we ourselves use the different mediums and the different kinds of message shapes in order to give kind of layers of meaning to our actual meaning in the words. And I just want to come back to the thought of not paying for an extra message and therefore just sending something off that's not actually ready to be sent off necessarily, right? We wouldn't just, when we write a letter, we wouldn't just write one sentence on the letter and then send it, right? And then have 24 letters because we have 24 lines. That doesn't make sense at all. But with WhatsApp, for example, or with Facebook, that's possible. So that kind of makes, that doesn't only make the full stop redundant, and I think there's a whole different episode on the full stop here, because we don't need the full stop anymore if we just send the message off. It's clear that that's one unit, right? But it also makes the notion of paragraph redundant. Indentation we can totally forget about, right? But even the paragraph doesn't exist anymore, because we don't have that visual entity and parceling off. And of course we also have the illusion of eternity with an ever producing scroll. The scroll is never ended, right? Or like with the BBC news website, one message really is one paragraph. So paragraphs, the notion of paragraph is not several sentences anymore, but just anything that you send off, anything that's one message. But I think because it's so easy now to just keep sending avalanches of messages, we kind of forget that they too leave a trace. And that sort of, they're invisible, they're digital traces, and they are kind of invisible, but they are there. It's just so mind-boggling to think, well, those things are invisible and we can't touch them, but they're there, right? It's a digital noise. It's electricity somewhere other in, stored in one server or other. And I think that's really interesting to think about, because blanks on pages, actual physical pages and in actual books, blanks are also an object lesson, because when we write on a piece of paper, the blank is just white, right? There's nothing there, but yet there's the paper there. So we are kind of aware that there's something. And for the mechanism of the printing press, that's kind of similar, because the way things were, the way things were printed is that the composer, which would really usually be a man, women were very involved in the trade, so they would be selling books, they would maybe sew the books together or help in the binding or something. But the printing, the actual, you know, putting letters together and using the printing press, that was a man's job. I would be very interested if somebody has information on whether women would do that as well. Women were very involved, but that part was for men. So you would have the typesetter, who would have a kind of wooden tray, which is called a composing stick, in one hand, and then have sort of tweezers, I suppose, or like a something to pinch in any case, like an instrument to pinch the little pieces of type, so like little metal pieces with the letters on them, and put them in the into the composing stick. And this is quite interesting because there's several ways people would go about that. So you have a printer who's maybe sitting somewhere or standing in front of a desk with two levels of case. And case means basically just the little piece of metal where the letter is on, or the punctuation mark, for example. And we have uppercase and we have lowercase, right? So uppercase is the capital letters, and lowercase, this is also where punctuation was, for example, is for lowercase letters, for minuscule. And this is where our uppercase, lowercase, capital, minuscule comes from. So the case would be in front of him, and either somebody would read out what he was supposed to be setting, the lines, or he would have the manuscript next to him, maybe on an extra desk or something like that, or like a book rest or something. And very often, actually, the handwriting was not very readable, and so lots of kind of spelling, diverse kind of spelling, might actually not be intended by an author, but might go back to the typesetter just not being able to read a handwriting, the handwriting of the manuscript. So here is the typesetter. In whichever way things are happening, he needs to put the type into the composing stick. And of course, he needs to do that in like, mirroring it. So when later it will be printed, it will be the right way around so we can read it. And the way things would stick together on the composing stick would be that there was no glue, there was no rope that would hold the type together. But each piece of type would be so tightly set that they hold each other, as it were. There's no space left in between them, so they would, you know, just fall out of the composing stick. Everything was so tightly together that even if you like turn it around, it wouldn't fall out. But how do you do that if you need space between words, right? And like blank spaces, because it's not continuous script anymore. We now have spaces between words. And that those spaces would be strips of lead that wherein as high as the letters. So when you have your letter on the type on a little piece of metal, it would be carved, or the original it's called a matrix, the original piece would be carved, but then the type is being, you know, the hot metal, the molten metal would be poured into the form, and these are complicated processes and so on. But in any case, you have your piece of metal, and then there's in relief the letter on it. And so, of course, if you want to have a blank, so you want to have a piece of metal that doesn't catch ink, so you need to have that a little bit lower than the letters, so there's no relief. It's just a strip of metal, as it were. And that goes between the words or between the paragraphs. So when you print that, then it's going to be invisible. It's just page, because there has been something, but this something hasn't caught any ink. So blanks are actually stuff that there is. It's not that there's nothing for a blank. A blank is something. A blank is an object. It's just not visible. So that's like an invisible presence. And again, it goes back to designers shuffling around not just marks, not just texts or decoration, but also space. They shuffle around space, like really for real, in a way. And the same, I guess, goes with WhatsApp messages, that, you know, there is stuff. It's not nothing. It's not like speech, where speech just dissolves in a way. So what is the future of the paragraph and of indentation? Do we have to be worried? I think yes and no, like with all of those things. I don't use e-readers, but I'm told that they still use indentation. So a digital text production thing that wants to imitate books will probably still imitate paragraphs, long paragraphs, and indentation. And in general, when it comes to things like spelling, punctuation, and other kinds of habits of writing, as long as there's a diversity of looks and of objects, we don't have to worry. So as long as we are still reading actual books and they keep their habits of paragraphing and indentation, as long as we still have magazines and newspapers, it's okay to read news online and to have them in a different format, which is kind of the appropriate format for online, right? It's okay to shoot off several messages one after the other and use emoji to structure your paragraphs as well, or to express yourself. All of those things are fine, because we are so adept at managing and negotiating and kind of knowing which is appropriate. One wouldn't maybe send an emoji to one's boss. I have an account with a bank that regularly sends emoji in their emails, and it really puts me off, because to me, at least, again, maybe I'm a little bit too old, an emoji is something between friends and it's conversational, and I don't want my bank to seem my friend. I kind of want to trust it, and to me it's not very trustworthy. But I think because it irks me, that is interesting, you know, it kind of rubs me the wrong way. So there is something and that it does to me because I'm not used to it, right? So all of those things are good, because they make us think, they make us talk, they make us realize how very adept we are with juggling language, juggling the form of language, the paragraph, the indentation, the punctuation, and the person that's receiving the message, and the situation in which the message is being sent. All of those matter, and I think as long as we have a diversity, it's okay. What I do have a problem with, I think, is what the UK government is doing with its 25-word sentences. Because all of their publications will be like that, they say. And that's what worries me, because that is kind of peddles a kind of uniformity that I think is dangerous. Because I think, complex things to be expressed in a way that does honor to the complexity. It doesn't mean that you need to use jargon. It doesn't mean that you need to make it utterly obscure. But don't belittle people and don't patronize people by saying, oh, by the way, you won't understand it if it's 26 words, you know. The government could have pages for easy language and then, you know, sort of medium kind of a way of expressing something that is still accessible, but that just honors the complexity of the topic. And that's also what a government is for, right? Like, I would imagine that we want the smartest people who can still speak to everybody to work on those things and on those publications and circulation of information. So why does the paragraph matter? Why does indentation matter? I think it matters because, like other kinds of punctuation, it tells us who we are and what we do and how we interact with one another. And I think the history of the paragraph and indentation, its presence, how it changes, how it's being used, all of this is an indication of where we were and where we're going and what kind of different behaviors, different mediums encourage in us, afford us. So I feel like paragraphs and indentations are both symptoms of where we are right now and where we have been. And they're also agents because they allow us to do certain things. I will use a indentation consciously if I want to express this or that. And I will shoot off a message if I want to express urgency, if I want to, you know, express neediness, or if I want attention. And I think those the paragraph and the indentation, the little signs that seem so commonplace and humdrum and even invisible, they are actually, that's where the big stuff is happening. That's you know, when we give that attention, we realize how sophisticated the mind is, how sophisticated human communication is. And no matter how intelligent any artificial thing is, something that we created, I don't even want to call it a creature or a mind, no matter how intelligent that is, we will still be able to do more. A browser can't justify the margins, and I think that's kind of a great lesson from this whole thing of about paragraphing and indentation. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you go off and read with a bit of attention and consciousness some BBC news websites, and have a look at your own texting habits, and see how, where you belong. Are you the quick message sender? Are you the paragraph writer, or are you the the novel texter? Thank you, and I hope to see you soon.